history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some ridiculously exciting and entertaining stories to share if we take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear another one today. In fact, if you caught our last program, you heard a veteran by the name of Cal Erickson tell his story, but say, hey, my story's nothing. You ought to hear from my brother. Well, today we hear from one of his brothers, Grant Erickson, 94 years old, of Santa Cruz, California, and the 10th out of 11 children growing up. So by the time you came along, I guess your folks must have had it figured out. I mean, they must have had a well-oiled machine going there.
I think they must have had, yes.
And did your older siblings pick on you? Did they whip you into shape? What was
Not
that like?
Not really. No, you know, life was, I think it was terrific. I think I fought more with my younger brother, though. The two of us pretty scrapped quite a bit.
He was the one that you could push around a little?
Yeah, that's right.
And you grew up in Central California?
Yes, Delray, on a farm. We were growing mostly grapes and alfalfa, things like that, tree fruit.
Did you have to work on the farm?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had to stack trays when the rain came, you know, when we had the grapes and making raisins.
So you had to get the raisins out of the rain or else
they'd
get moldy.
That's right.
It's funny how that's still the way it works. All these years later, the technology really hasn't changed all that much.
I think that's probably right.
Was that pretty hard work? I mean, is that how you remember
it? Oh, it wasn't too bad. No, I kind of enjoyed it, actually.
When you think back to those days, I know that's a long time ago. We're talking more than 80 years ago if we go really back to your childhood. Do you remember having any dreams or ambitions or the thoughts of what I'm going to do someday when I get off this farm?
From an early age, I thought I'd like to be a teacher someday. Mm-hmm. All of my brothers were farmers mostly, so I decided, well, I'd kind of like to fall in line with the girls.
Was that it? You wanted to meet the girls? You figured there's a lot of females teaching?
Well, that was part of it. Yeah, I graduated from Sanger High School. You probably know all about Sanger.
The Apaches.
Yes,
sure.
The Apaches, that's right. Went to Fresno State. Eventually, when I was home on leave from the ship, in 1944, I married my wife. We hadn't had a date until we were seniors in college, actually. I think I was kind of a slow learner.
Because you'd known her your whole life.
I'd gone to elementary school with her, high school, and so forth.
Right.
Same church, youth group. Yep.
How about that? Well, I want to trace some of these steps. So you graduate from Sanger High School. You go to Fresno State.
Yes.
Which then was just a teacher's college.
That's
there
right.
There wasn't a lot more going on. Now it's a huge ag school, has so many different programs and all the big sports programs.
Right.
Although there were some pretty good sports teams then. I mean, they
had
a pretty
were.
Good football club, didn't they?
That's right.
Well, I imagine you were at Fresno State when Pearl Harbor happened.
That's right.
What do you remember about that day, December 7th?
Well, I remember that it kind of just, I was stunned. It was almost unbelievable, really.
And you would end up one of five brothers who served in the war.
Right.
Were any of them in the service yet when that happened?
One of my brothers, Lambert, was the first one of us to go into the service. And he became a field artillery officer serving in the South Pacific, mostly in the Philippine area. My brother, Ralph, went in next. But I think he went in 1942 and served aboard the USS Washington, which is a beautiful battleship. Mm-hmm. Actually, in comparing his battleship to mine, the New Mexico, I loved my duty, but it wasn't quite as safe as being on the Washington because they had better 5-inch 38 guns as opposed to 5-inch 25 on our ship, which were not as good as the others.
Your ship was a little more seasoned.
That's right.
Had a little more history behind
it. Yeah, that's right.
When did you get this idea, though, about the Navy, because it sounds like your idea was, I'll finish up school at Fresno State and get my degree before anything happens with the military.
Well, when I went into the service, I thought I would like to go into the Navy, but I thought that I would like to finish my degree first. So I signed up for the officer's training program that allowed me to get my degree at Fresno State in 1943. And I got it 6 weeks before the end of school, because Northwestern University had new class starting, and they needed 4 or 5 new additional officers to complete the class. And so I got my degree and my credentials a little bit early. Didn't have to take my final exams, which was great.
Yeah, that's the way to do
it. I wasn't too good in trigonometry.
So it worked out exactly how you wanted it to.
Right.
Until you got to midshipman school at Northwestern.
At Northwestern. I tell you, we got back there to Chicago. We stayed at Evanston, Illinois. It was assigned to the 14th floor, as I recall, in a big bunk room with 15 others. We had 8 double bunk beds. I hardly made it through the Navy that first night. Actually, the first thing we did when we got there was to take the obstacle course, and that was something that I hadn't been used to. It. We had to run through it not only once but twice, and I was dead to the world, you might say, when I went to sleep that night. And I had a little, one of those guys that would talk in my sleep a little bit. So right in the middle of the night, I yelled, fire!
Uh-oh.
And everybody jumped out of their bunks except me. They said, I said, well, why doesn't somebody turn off the water or something like that? Well, they could have killed me. So you see what I mean? But anyway, that was the first day in the Navy.
I guess so. So you end up commissioned at a rather young age. And I've heard a lot of people talk over the years about the 90-day wonders, and you were
That's
one
right.
of those.
I was one of those. That's right. Pearl Harbor happened, and we had to get a lot more people qualified quickly. So I became a 90-day wonder. And, of course, I learned a lot of things at Northwestern, seamanship, gunnery, and all of that. That was a part of the curriculum that I hadn't ever had much to do with, you know, at Fresno State. But it was great. I didn't mind it a bit.
And before you got to your ship, the New Mexico, which you have quite an encyclopedic knowledge of now and have quite a history with, you did some training on the battleship New York?
The battleship New York in Norfolk, Virginia. The New York is equipped with 12 14-inch guns, big guns. I had 6 weeks of training in, of course, the projectiles, and the powder to blow them was so heavy that they had to use a hoist to load the guns, you know.
Yeah.
And so had went through all of that operation, and I was hoping that I wouldn't have gunnery duty.
You didn't want any part of that.
Didn't want any part of that.
And that's how it worked out for you when you got aboard
yes,
the
did.
New Mexico, and that
yes.
was October of 43. And little did you know what you would see and experience on that ship. But it's pretty unique for a young man your age to have the kind of duties that you had and the interactions that you had with the
yes.
top officers on that ship.
Yeah.
A pretty historic ship.
Yes.
What was it like for you when you first went aboard the Queen, as they called her?
The Queen. It was very pleasant. The fellows were all great, and we had a bunch of wonderful officers. I mean, there was a lot of camaraderie, you know. It was great. I had the feeling that, well, here we go. We're heading for Pearl Harbor, and the captain gave a wonderful speech and told us that we'd soon be in the thick of things, you know. Kind of gave us a little bit of an idea of what to expect. Our main job as a ship was to cover the landing of our troops, mm-hmm. Army troops. And the idea in any battle, in any situation like that, was that our newer ships would go in ahead of time and do the damage, kind of clear it for the troops, you know.
The bombardment.
Yeah, that's right, for the bombardment. And then they would leave, and then we would take over and cover the landings and, you know, fire our 14-inch guns. Our first operation was in the Gilberts at Macon Island. I think the biggest eye-opener, you might say, at Macon Island. We were there to cover a landing, and we were anchored off of the island. And about 6 o'clock one morning, it was a tremendous blast. It was dark out, and I ran up topside And all I could see off of our starboard bow, about 1,000 yards off, was the complete outline of a ship, which was in total flames. It turned out that the Liscombe Bay, which had been a cruiser reconverted into a carrier, had been struck by torpedoes, Japanese torpedoes. There were, I think, 52 officers and 591 enlisted men who went down to their graves that morning along with the ship. Didn't last very long. Aboard our ship were even certain body parts and things like that. It was just, you know, that was the beginning of the war, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, that is quite a welcome to the war.
Real life.
How did you digest that? How did you process that?
Well, I sort of took the attitude that I was there to do a job, you know what I mean? And not all in a day's work, but, you know, had a job to do. And I think my training through the year as I grew to manhood, you might say, I think my faith took me through, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I've always been connected with a church, and I think the spiritual education that I received as a youngster and on through the years helped me a lot. I think it caused me to face anything that came along.
Well, maybe we can explore that later when we hear some of the things that did come along, because they're pretty significant. I know we're bouncing around a little bit, but you mentioned your captain.
Yes.
And you have a great photo album here that we were just looking at. There's some photos of that captain, and you've also written down some of the things you remember him saying. And I got the sense that his speech when you went aboard the New Mexico, and you'd end up working fairly closely with him.
Yes.
But that his speech really had an impact on you.
It did.
What was the biggest impact of that, or the thing that he said that really stuck with you or really kind of crystallized your focus?
I think it was that we were all in this together. And if we all did our job that we were assigned to do, that we would make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I had the feeling that he really knew what he was doing, too. I felt safe. One time, one of our captains, we were involved in an air attack, and general quarters was sounded, and I know that there was one young enlisted man going up to his battle station, which was in forward aft. He was almost to the ladder. He started to go up and started to come down. He was just really kind of psychologically messed up. The captain happened to be there, and he put his hand on the boy's shoulder, and he said, "What's the matter, son? Are you scared?" He said, "I sure am." And the captain said, "Well, so am I. And don't let anybody tell you I'm not."
Wow.
I mean, that, you know, coming from the captain of the ship was, you know, very meaningful.
I could see that. I wonder how many captains would have the humility and transparency to say that.
Yeah, that's right.
You made reference to some of your duties on the ship. What were some of the other things you were responsible for?
Most of my watches were spent 4 hours on, you know, and then off and so forth. In the CIC, which is Combat Information Center, where the radars who do all the plotting and so forth and so on. And then I stood watches on the navigation bridge. Because I did, I think I had the opportunity to know the captains more intimately, perhaps, than many of the people aboard the ship, you know, could, especially during general quarters when we were under attack. It had to be at our battle station, and my battle station was the navigation bridge. I was close to the operation and could see what the captain was doing. And, of course, the captain lives on the bridge. Has his own little compartment there. I think I was blessed to have such wonderful captains. They were all just terrific.
So you mentioned when the Liscombe Bay gets blown to bits, really.
Yes.
I mean, to the point that some of it was coming onto your ship. You witnessed that devastation. Did that send a message to you? I mean, did you receive a message there that, hey, this very same thing could happen to me? This really is dangerous?
I didn't think of that often, really. I guess I sort of thought, well, if something happens, it happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. And maybe before we get into some more of the specifics and the close calls you had, maybe you can put your ship in perspective for us. Because you talked about that this is a battleship. You talked about the role of it. But what about the size and the scope of it? I imagine coming from a small farm town in Central California, this is a pretty eye-opening experience to be on this giant battleship with all this firepower.
Yeah, it was. Actually, it was just short of 2 football fields in length.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty big. Of course, the nice thing about being on a battleship in rough weather, the listing is not that much as it is if you're on a destroyer, for example. Sure. You just go almost tip over, you know. And the width of, actually, when we came back after the war, went through the Panama Canal and decommissioned in Boston, I think we cleared the Panama Canal, but see, it's 6 inches because that we were that wide.
Yeah. Scraping the sides, huh?
Yeah, right.
Well, we haven't even scratched the surface of Grant Erickson's Navy experiences during World War II. When we come back, we'll hear how he survived a kamikaze attack on the USS New Mexico in January 1945. Head to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and videos of Grant. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.